old frenzy of the physicians working hard to defibrillate or resuscitate them. Others claim to have gone through brightly lighted tunnels into a world where they were welcomed by angelic figures and dead members of their own families. Experiencers come back from these encounters changed for the better and convinced they are proof of the existence of the soul, an immortal entity that is related to but is independent of the body and goes on to another life when the body packs in. But not all near-death experiences are pleasant. About 23% of those reported are described as distressing. They tell of finding themselves in an ugly and foreboding landscape where the soul, though not being actively punished, experiences a desolating void. Skeptical scientists do not deny these near-death experiences in either their positive or negative forms, but they offer naturalistic or materialistic explanations for them. They think they do not so much prove the existence of the soul as reflect a previously held belief in its existence, which is then used to interpret what occurred. Skeptics offer a different explanation. They describe NDEs as hallucinations, events in the human mind with no reality outside it, induced by oxygen shortage, a common result of cardiac arrest. The experiencers were not actually floating outside themselves, but the neural connections that linked them to their own bodies had shut down and induced a feeling of separation. And it is well known that drugs can produce the same effect. I remember visiting a parishioner in Edinburgh's old Royal Infirmary late one winter afternoon. He'd suffered heart problems for years and was being treated for yet another attack. When I arrived at his bedside in the huge ward, he indicated that he wanted me to pull the screens round the bed so they couldn't hear us talking. Then he whispered to me that at 3 o'clock that morning his doctors and nurses had taken him to the fourth bridge and suspended him over the dark waters below, where for hours he hung terrified, and he knew they were planning another excursion for him tonight. I told him not to be afraid, I'd deal with it. On my way out, I spoke to the ward sister. "It'll be that new drug he's on," she said. "We'll change it." They did, and the hallucination ceased, but not before they'd scared him almost to death. If this proves nothing else, it reminds us that the human mind is a mysterious shifting continent, and we have only just begun to explore it. The mind is its own place and does its own thing. In our time, it's being investigated by psychologists and neuroscientists, but artists have always been its best explorers. The poet John Milton said the mind could make a hell of heaven or a heaven of hell. The poet Gerard Manley Hopkins knew how frightening it could be. Oh, the mind, mind has mountains, cliffs of fall, frightful sheer, no man fathomed. Hold them cheap may who ne'er hung there. For as far back as we can trace our own story, death has been one of the mind's obsessions. And it seems to be unique to us. So obsessed are we with the knowledge of our mortality that Martin Heidegger, one of the great philosophers of the 20th century, defined the human animal as a being towards death, one who was always old enough to die and knew it. He described our condition as thrownness, finding ourselves thrust or thrown into a life we neither asked for nor understand the meaning of, yet with the knowledge that one day, maybe one day soon, it would be taken from us. On earth, maybe even in the whole universe, this knowledge seems to be unique to us. Of course, it is impossible for us to fathom the inner or spiritual lives of the other creatures we share the world with, but they do not seem to live with the constant knowledge that one day they'll die. In a chorus from his play, The Dog Beneath the Skin, W.H. Auden meditates on the unself-conscious immediacy of the animal's life. Happy the hare at morning, for she cannot read the hunter's waking thoughts. Lucky the leaf, unable to predict the fall. The mineral stars disintegrating quietly into light. But what shall man do, who can whistle tunes by heart, know to the bar when death shall cut him short, like the cry of the sheer water? All animals fight death when it threatens, like Leonard Woolf's blind puppies, and there is evidence that some of them grieve the death of their fellows, but most of them seem to move on and forget what happened. They certainly don't care for their dead the way we do. They let them disintegrate where they drop, whereas we give our dead funerals and erect memorials to them and go on wondering what has happened to them. In fact, it would be little exaggeration to say that it was the fate of the dead that started us thinking about ourselves and the world in which we found ourselves. Much came from that thinking, including religion, which is best understood as belief in spheres of reality behind or beyond, but related to the one we inhabit while we are alive. And looking at the dead and wondering what happened to them might have been what got it going. The most obvious thing they noticed about the dead was that something that used to happen in them had stopped happening. They no longer breathed. It was a small step to associate the act of breathing with the idea of something dwelling within, yet separate from, the physical body that gave it life. The Greeks called it psyche, the Romans spiritus, both from verbs meaning to breathe or blow. A spirit or soul was what made a body live and breathe. It inhabited the body for a time, and when the body died, it departed. But where did it go? One explanation was that it had gone somewhere else, the way a person could inhabit a place for a time, then move out. This somewhere else grew into the idea of a spiritual world on the flip side of the physical one we inhabit while we are alive on earth. Though our distant ancestors left only silent traces of their thinking, from about 130,000 BCE onwards, we have discovered evidence that may point to a belief in life after death. Food, tools, and ornaments were placed in graves, suggesting that the dead were thought to have travelled on into some kind of afterlife and needed to be equipped for the journey. Another practice was the painting of the bodies of the dead with red ochre, maybe to symbolize blood and the idea of continuing life. This was found in one of the oldest known burials of a mother and child at Kafseh in Israel from around 100,000 BCE. The same practice is found in Australia in 42,000 BCE at Lake Mango, where the body was also covered in red ochre. By 10,000 BCE, we have evidence that burial rites were not only more elaborate, but in some places they had also become ferociously cruel, with the execution of wives and servants as part of the funeral ceremony. The slaughter of the widows of important men has been widely practiced in different cultures, though whether to maintain the comfort and status of the VIP in the life that awaited him after death, or as a way of appeasing or buying off the spirits of the dead, we cannot say for certain. And marking where the dead lay became important, especially if they were significant figures. Sometimes they were laid under gigantic boulders, sometimes in carefully constructed stone chambers called dolmens, which consisted of two upright stones supporting a large lid. It has been suggested that piling boulders over the graves of the dead might have been designed to keep them underground where they belonged, so that they wouldn't start wandering the earth as ghosts. Even now, there are people who are reluctant to walk through a graveyard alone on a dark night, for fear of what they might encounter, proof that ancient anxieties about the state of the dead still persist. An old fear is that some of the dead are either unable to accept or are unaware of the fact that they are dead, so they can't move on and hang around to haunt the living. A practicing psychic I knew once told me that after 1945, he had been used by a Department of the War Office to settle the unquiet spirits of soldiers whose bodies had been obliterated by bombs that had left no physical trace of their existence. There's an enormous literature about the existence of these displaced entities. We call them ghosts, the old English word for spirits, disembodied souls who hang around their old neighbourhoods. Most priests have been called upon to try to deal with the presence of unsettled spirits haunting a house and distressing the living. I've been called upon several times in this way and have always responded positively. At the time, I was more open to the possibility of the supernatural than I am now, but even then I was never sure whether I was ministering to the living or the dead. But what I did always seemed to settle the disturbance. Maybe it was another example of the usefulness of negative capability in responding to human need. It was the act itself, not how I understood it, that mattered. On one occasion, I was phoned by the warden of a university hall of residence at the top of the Royal Mile in Edinburgh. A group of students had been fooling around with a Ouija board when the room suddenly became icy cold and they were spooked by a sense of presence. Ouija boards, from the French word for yes, are flat slabs with letters, numbers, symbols, and the words yes, no, and goodbye on them. Participants placed their fingers on a heart-shaped piece of wood or plastic called a planchette. Guided or prompted by the dead, who are trying to get in touch, the planchette moves around the board, spelling out words and messages for the living. Skeptics say the planchette's movement is achieved by the body's own reflexes, what they call the ideomotor effect, a bit like the naturalistic explanation of NDEs as hallucinations. As with a lot of the weird stuff that happens to us, they say it's all in the mind. But we've already registered that the human mind has a disconcerting power that's all its own. It has even been claimed that those who have survived near-death experiences have an effect on electrical equipment. It's reported that at one conference of near-death experiencers, the hotel's computer system went down. So it's not hard to believe that if the mind can interfere with the computer's software, it could much more easily mess with a body's temperature levels. However you explain what happens in a Ouija board session, the effects can be spooky and scary, as they were that Sunday night in an old building up near Edinburgh Castle. I prayed with the students, the atmosphere shifted, and calm was restored. On another occasion, I was asked by the owner of an ancient castle south of Edinburgh, which he ran as a hotel, if I could help him. Some of his cleaners had refused to work in a room in the castle because of its unearthly coldness and sense of oppressive despair. His research had suggested that centuries ago children had been murdered in that room. He didn't know what to believe, except that it was damaging his business and upsetting his staff. Could I help? Again, I prayed with the owner and his staff, and whatever the disturbance was, or wherever it was happening, in the room or in the minds of the cleaners, the situation was calmed. However we interpret or explain these experiences, in them we catch a glimpse of belief in another world or another life beyond this one, which is connected to it, with death as the gateway between them. But let me leave ghosts to their wanderings on this side of death and ask a different question. Is anything waiting for us on the other side? Whether we actually experience what is happening to us when we die, whether we are conscious of the ferry pulling out from the shore or the bus moving away from the curb, the big question is whether it's taking us anywhere. We die, then what? What happens next? Very different answers have been given to that question. I'll begin with the most complicated, which comes from India, and the oldest of the organized religions, Hinduism. According to Hindu teaching, your soul or spirit is a wanderer that's had many lives in the past before it came into the one you happen to be in at the moment, and it will live many more lives in the future when this one is over. The technical term for this belief is reincarnation or metempsychosis, and it's an intricate version of the doctrine of predestination we thought about in the previous chapter. Each of your lives will be determined by how you acted in the one before this, just as how you are behaving now will influence the kind of life you'll have on the next turn of the wheel. This is called the doctrine of karma, or the law of the deed. Actions have consequences. When the thinkers of India looked at the dead and wondered where they had gone, this was the idea they came up with. Souls did not die, either in the sense that they ceased altogether, or in the sense that they travelled on into another sphere of permanent existence beyond death. The Hindu mind believed that the soul came back to earth again in another body, whose status was dictated by its karma. Existence was a colossal recycling process in which the quality of the life that went through the door marked death affected the status of what emerged through the door on the other side marked rebirth. They called the system samsara, or wandering through, because souls were carried through it to their next shape and the next and the one after that, far into the disappearing future. For good or ill, every action the soul committed in its current life affected the quality of its next appearance. But they did not think of karma as a punishment devised by a heavenly judge. It was an impersonal law, like gravity, in which one thing followed another as effect followed cause. In its wanderings, the soul might go through millions of lives before achieving escape into a state called nirvana, from a word meaning to be blown out like a candle. How to escape from the wheel of existence and be blown into nothingness was the ultimate purpose of Hindu religion. It's interesting that at its center is the idea that existence can become a burden and failure to die a torment. Here it reflects another of the mind's obsessions that has also been well rehearsed by poets. A Greek myth captures the sorrow of it. The myth concerns a beautiful Trojan called Tithonus, who asked the goddess Aurora for immortality. But he forgot to ask for eternal youth and vigor, so he grew old and weak, but could never die. His predicament was captured by the English poet Alfred Lord Tennyson. The woods decay and fall, the vapors weep their burthen to the ground. Man comes and tills the field and lies beneath, and after many summers dies the swan. Me only cruel immortality consumes. I wither slowly in thine arms, a white-haired shadow roaming like a dream the ever-silent spaces of the east. Imagine what that would be like. Actually, it doesn't take much imagination, because the karma of modern medicine keeps too many people alive long after any pleasure or meaning has gone from their lives. Sentenced to years of mournful dissolution, many of them long to be blown out like a candle. Skeptics are usually too quick to reject the narratives of religion, especially if they believe them to be as unlikely as the multiple elaborations of Hinduism. They fail to realize that they are one of the ways in which the human mind gives form to its fears and anxieties. That's why the ideas of karma and samsara can carry meaning for people who continue to take them seriously long after they've ceased to take them literally. And it's why the word karma has become shorthand for understanding important aspects of human behavior. Our acts have consequences, not only for ourselves, but for others, and they can reverberate down the ages. Because our fathers ate sour grapes yesterday, our teeth are set on edge today. The soul's wandering through samsara may be a wearisome prospect, but the alternative offered by the other two big religions in the world is, if anything, even more depressing. Hinduism promises an ultimate escape from existence after many false starts. However long it takes, one day our candle will be blown out, because in Hinduism, God, or ultimate reality, is infinitely patient. In the words of the poet A.S.J. Tessemond, "He gives you time in heaven to do as you please, to climb love's gradual ladder by slow degrees, gently to rise from sense to soul, to ascend to a world of timeless joy, world without end." That's not how it goes in Christianity and Islam. According to these religious systems, the human soul is a one-shot deal that is heavy with eternal consequences. What we make of ourselves in the single life we get on earth determines where and how we'll spend it in the next. We don't get to come back again and again till we finally achieve a pass and go on to the University of Nirvana. Our one life is an examination in which no resits are permitted. Heaven is the name of the destination for those who pass, hell for those who fail. Though it takes their existence for granted, Christianity's scripture, the New Testament, is sparing in its descriptions of heaven and hell, a reserve that was more than compensated for by later preachers and theologians, as we'll see. Where the New Testament was reticent, the Quran was clear from the beginning. It contains a number of chapters or surahs in which heaven and hell are described. The most famous is Surah 56, on the Day of Judgment. Heaven or paradise is a garden of delight that might have been designed for the exclusive enjoyment of the male of the human species. As a reward for their sufferings on earth, there are springs of wine on tap that don't intoxicate or cause a hangover, and beautiful, wide-eyed young women are available for their enjoyment. That's what's prepared for those the Quran calls companions of the right, the good. It's a very different deal for those it calls the companions of the left, the wicked. It's hell for them, mid burning winds and boiling waters and the shadow of a smoking blaze. In both Christianity and Islam, just as heaven is a place of unending joy, so is hell a place of unending torment. Hell is pain without any hope of respite or release. It is a furnace that never fails. Here's a description of its chemistry from a sermon the Irish writer James Joyce heard when he was a schoolboy. "The sulphurous brimstone which burns in hell is a substance which is specially designed to burn forever and forever with unspeakable fury. Moreover, our earthly fire destroys at the same time as it burns, so that the more intense it is, the shorter is its duration. But the fire of hell has this property, that it preserves that which it burns, and though it rages with incredible intensity, it rages forever." St. Thomas Aquinas, the Catholic Church's greatest theologian, claimed that one of the attractions of heaven was that it had a convenient balcony from which its citizens could watch the torments of the damned down below. "The blessed in the kingdom of heaven will see the punishments of the damned, so that their bliss will be that much greater." But Aquinas was also the theologian who offered a way to avoid hell with the invention of purgatory, the spiritual laundry system we thought about in chapter 1. This is an example of how the more thoughtful religions have been good at finding ways to soften their own doctrinal excesses. There have even been Christian theologians who believe that while hell existed in theory, in practice it had never acquired any inhabitants. It's worth noting here that those who invented these post-mortem destinations were never in agreement about the timings involved in the transitions between them. Some gave the impression that at death the transfer was immediate, One moment you were alive in this world, you died, and the next moment you face the judge who would immediately determine your forthcoming destination, hell, purgatory, or heaven. This is still the official position of the Roman Catholic Church. It teaches that just as the soul was created at the instant of conception, so at the instant of death, it immediately faces judgment. This is why it continues to warn the faithful against dying unconfessed and unprepared. There's an older tradition that saw judgment not as an individual but as a group process. All the world's dead would hibernate in their graves until the day of judgment. The last trumpet would sound, their atoms would reassemble into resurrected bodies, and they would stand to hear their fate. The belief that the bodies, as well as the souls of the dead, would rise from their graves to be judged on the last day had a profound effect on Christian burial customs. Cremation was a problem because it made the reassembling of the body hard to imagine. That was why in the Roman Empire, under the influence of Christianity, by the 5th century cremation had been abandoned. It was not revived in the West till the 19th century. Even then, it took Christian churches a long time to accept it. The Roman Catholic Church did not permit its use till 1963. Uneasiness about it persists, reflected in a Vatican decree in 2016 forbidding Catholics from keeping the ashes of their departed at home, scattering them in nature, or dividing them between members of the family. Ashes are only to be kept in holy places, such as churches or cemeteries. If you are confident in your religious faith, these inconsistencies may not trouble you. But what are those of us who can't take them literally to make of them? A good way to think about religion is as a Rorschach test that maps humanity's psychic geography. It reveals us to ourselves. So the question is whether religion causes or just expresses and gives form to our obsession with death. The answer seems to be a bit of both. Religion emphasizes our fear of death in order to assuage it. It frightens in order to save, because it takes death very seriously and thinks we should as well. Catholicism has been pastorally more skillful at managing these complexities than the severer versions of Protestantism. Catholicism's description of hell were terrifying, but they were always followed by helpful directions on how to avoid it. And the reassurance of their last rites took a lot of the anguish out of dying. That's why Catholic army chaplains were thought to be more effective than Protestants in ministering to dying soldiers in no man's land in the First World War. They had a rite, a formal mechanism of mercy and forgiveness, that reassured the dying in their last moments in terrible circumstances. I have ministered these rites myself and seen the peace they can bring at the end. I have sent good friends into the arms of a merciful God I was no longer sure I believed in. And I was convinced not only of the efficacy, but of the honesty of what I was doing. I was not there to ventilate my doubts, but to help the dying find the strength to cast off and take the tide that was pulling them out. I have also been helpless to assuage the fear of a dying friend, because the dread that paralyzed him allowed me no way to console him. Brought up in a strict Calvinist sect, on his deathbed he reverted to the predestinarianism he'd been schooled in as a child. God, he had been taught, predestined some to heaven and some to hell, not for any good or ill they had done, but simply according to his mysterious will. How could he be certain what God intended for him, heaven or hell? I tried to batter through the fear that gripped him to open him to the loving God of the parables of Jesus, but he died in fear, not in hope. Whatever we make of the different responses of religion to death and what may follow, they show that from the beginning death has obsessed humanity. It continues to obsess us. It is what the theologian Paul Tillich called an ultimate concern. It comes with being human. We can't help wondering about it. But in our day, it is no longer just religion that offers us a way to transcend death and achieve everlasting life. Modern science has now entered the game. But there's a big difference between its approach and religion's. It's no longer God who offers us eternal life. It is science-based technology. And when it comes, it won't be lived in heaven. It will happen right here on earth. The plan is to conquer or outrun death so completely that we'll postpone it indefinitely. It will be immortality on the installment plan. The scientists who are working on it tell us they're not there yet, but they're speeding along nicely. Meanwhile, for those of us unfortunate enough to die before death has been finally conquered, the best bet is to have our corpses preserved by freezing them, cryopreserved in the jargon, so that science can resurrect them when it has perfected the technology. It is reminiscent of religious eschatology, but without the supernatural element. The last trump won't be blown by the Archangel Gabriel. A guy in a white coat will do it. It will be a secular salvation, the only one that'll work, according to its evangelists, because we are alone in the universe, and if we want to live forever, we'll have to see to it ourselves. So what will they do to us if we sign on for this eternal life plan? Or where do we go to get it done? There are four companies that offer the service, three in the United States and one in Russia. The largest is the Alcor Life Extension Foundation near Phoenix in Arizona. Alcor offers two procedures to customers who signed up for its version of eternal life. In the basic procedure, which costs $200,000, Alcor's technicians drain the blood from the corpse, patient in their lexicon, and replace it with antifreeze and other organ-preserving chemicals. It is then lowered head first into a tank or flask filled with liquid nitrogen, where it is preserved at a temperature of -190°C. There it will rest until secular resurrection day, when it will be thawed and reanimated to emerge blinking into the world of whatever century it happens to be at the time. There's a cheaper option at $80,000 called neuro-only, in which the head alone is preserved. The deal here is that on cryo-resurrection day, the brain and the mind it carries will be digitally scanned, purged of any unnecessary neuro-junk, and the good stuff left will be uploaded onto an artificial body or robotic prosthesis where it will exist forever, unimpeded by the ills that mortal flesh is heir to. It is reckoned that hundreds of people have already availed themselves of the opportunity and hang suspended in cold storage, waiting for Resurrection Day, some of them having taken their pets along with them for the ride. And it's reported that several thousand people still alive have signed up for the process and paid their deposit. Doubtless, cryopreservation will soon be an option in private health insurance plans, but it may not be the way to go in the long run. Better than dying and being cryopreserved till Resurrection Day would be not to die at all, or to live so long that you'd hardly know the difference. That's what the founder and director of Alcor is betting on. In a conversation with the writer Mark O'Connell, he explained it like this. I'm hoping to avoid having to be preserved. My ideal scenario is I stay healthy and take care of myself, and more funding goes into life extension research, and we actually achieve longevity escape velocity. He was referring here to the scenario projected by the life extension impresario Aubrey de Grey, a scientific advisor to Alcor, whereby for every year that passes, the process of longevity research is such that average human life expectancy increases by more than a year, a situation that would in theory lead to our effectively outrunning death. Many scientists doubt the effectiveness of the processes on offer and believe that the brain will be irreversibly damaged by the antifreeze pumped into it. And they think it highly unlikely that we will achieve enough longevity escape velocity to outrun death forever. But it's not the science that bothers me. Clever humans are constantly breaking the sound barrier of what's achievable. So who's to say that bringing the frozen dead back to life will never happen? Or extracting the human mind from its perishable container of flesh and uploading it onto an imperishable machine? Or outrunning death so effectively that the CEO of Alcor will get the 1,000 years he desires? It's what comes next that worries me. We're a clever and revolutionary species, and we've spent our history achieving the impossible. But we've been bad at anticipating the effect of our inventiveness, not only on our own health and happiness, but also on the health of the planet that is still our only viable home. So it's worth giving the anti-death movement some thought. We should certainly be concerned about the cryopreserved individuals who will emerge blinking into the light of a world that may be beyond their comprehension and for which they will be totally unprepared. I suppose it is possible that a government of the future might organize some kind of reception process for these refugees from the past. They might cluster them together in communities of the ex-dead, because who else could possibly understand their situation? But I wouldn't bet on their getting a generous reception from the not-yet-dead section of the population. Humanity has a bad record when it comes to welcoming strangers, especially if they're considered strange or different, and strange these returnees from death will certainly be. If it works, the problems will soon pile up. How many cryonic cycles will be permitted for each individual? Will people keep dying and coming back? And what about the poor? How are they going to respond to yet another privilege only the wealthy will be able to afford? The process is expensive, so the poor will have to stay dead when they die or opt for an inferior resurrection deal, stoking rebellion at yet another form of discrimination. Traditional forms of discrimination based on race, gender, class, and wealth are dangerous and unhealthy for humanity, but at least they are finite. Death cancels them. In the grave, all are equal. But even if the grave can be bought off, in the future, we will have created the ultimate form of inequality. And we already know from our history how inequality promotes violence and revolt. The more daring and angry among the poor will organize themselves into protest movements to raid the cryonic storage facilities and drain the privileged dead of their antifreeze. They're also likely to turn their violence on the new strangers in their midst, the cryonically resurrected. As well as becoming victims of social tumult, the ex-dead will almost certainly suffer from psychological problems that will present the psychiatric community with yet another intractable human sorrow. Suicides will become epidemic amongst them, the ultimate irony, death as the friend of the ex-dead. But the danger will go far beyond the pain of individuals and communities. Suppose we muddle towards some sort of resolution of the problems the ex-dead will create for society. Suppose we slowly come to an accommodation with the reality of regiments of the ex-dead returning to life in our midst, either in their old bodies or transplanted into machines. We will have succeeded in fashioning a global boa constrictor that will slowly squeeze us all to death. Our already depleted planet will find it impossible to sustain an exponentially growing population of humans. And while the rest of humanity suffocates, the wealthy will gate themselves into fortified enclaves while they prepare rockets to get them off Earth onto palatial space satellites from which they'll watch the disintegration of our once hospitable blue planet, all because of our denial of death. I've delivered an apocalyptic scenario here. but it's mirrored in many of the dystopian fictions of our time, artists being our most reliable futurists. That's why it's worth contemplating where our denial of death might yet take us. The American theologian Reinhold Niebuhr wrote a prayer that was intended to instill a sense of realism in the way we manage human affairs. God, grant us the courage to change what can be changed, the serenity to accept what cannot be changed, and the wisdom to know the difference. A new clause might be added to the prayer to give it more relevance to the theme of this book. God, keep us from the folly of interfering too much with the imperatives and contingencies of nature. We are a clever but not always a wise species, so our battle not only to delay death, but to reverse it, may turn out to be the greatest folly in the long record of folly that is human history. If we refuse the paradox that it is through death that life is constantly renewed, we may end in the paradox that our denial of death has made life unbearable. It will take us all our wisdom to help us navigate the difference. Thinking about these rival eschatologies, the secular and the supernatural, the scientific or the religious, makes me wonder what it is that prompts us to want eternal life in either form. Is it a kind of fear? Not wanting to die too soon or before I am ready to leave the party? I can understand, but to fear leaving it? What's that about? I can understand the fear of death that religion might induce, given its descriptions of what might happen next. But why would unbelievers who reject any idea of an afterlife also fear death? And we know they do. We know that fear of death is an entirely ecumenical emotion. It's found in unbelievers as well as believers. The novelist Julian Barnes is one of them. He is an unbeliever who fears death and has written about it. Here's what he says in his book, Nothing to be Frightened Of. Perhaps the important divide is less between the religious and the irreligious as between those who fear death and those who don't. We fall thereby into four categories, and it's clear which two regard themselves as superior. Those who do not fear death because they have faith, and those who do not fear death despite having no faith. These groups take the moral high ground. In the third place come those who, despite having faith, cannot rid themselves of the old visceral, rational fear. And then, out of the meadows, below the salt, up Shit Creek, come those of us who fear death and have no faith. What is it that prompts what Barnes called the old visceral rational fear of death? What is he afraid of? If what awaits us after death is not samsara and its endless wandering through other lives, if it is not hell and its endless torment, if it is not even heaven and its endless joy, if it is no thing, nowhere, no anything, why fear it? Sadness at leaving, of course. Wistfulness at missing the future, particularly the future of those we love, of course, but fear of nothing? If we are fortunate enough not to have that fear, maybe we should listen to Julian Barnes again. For him, the fear of death is just there. It is intrinsic to death. Death carries it, comes with it. Timor mortis conturbat me, as an old litany has it. The fear of death disturbs me, deranges me. Even though there's nothing on the other side of it, even though death is the end, the full stop, the absolute cessation, the very thought of it scares us. It is as if, because being and the matter that clothed it once exploded into existence out of nothing, it now carries within itself the dread of returning to the void from which it escaped. Being dreads unbeing. It is the instinctive reflex of the little blind puppy again. But why doesn't it scare all of us? Is our hold on life less strong? I belong to one of the two categories Julian Barnes accuses of feeling superior because they do not fear death. The prospect of death saddens but does not frighten me, though I neither desire nor expect life after death. But it doesn't make me feel superior. People play the hand they are dealt in life. I was dealt several cards marked things to be afraid of, but nothingness was not one of them. Of course, I cannot be certain that, as I feel it approaching, I won't experience the old visceral, rational fear of death Barnes describes. After all, I've seen it happen to others. But if it does hit me, I hope I'll be brave enough to endure it. If I lie in fear on my deathbed, I hope someone will say to me, "Courage!" There are times when we just have to summon the courage to take what's coming. As Shakespeare put it in King Lear, we have to endure our going hence even as our coming hither. If courage is the wise person's response to the fear of going, what is the wise person's answer to those who insist on staying and lust for yet more life, either here on earth in a secular eternity or there in heaven in the supernatural version? In a word, it is gratitude. The opposite of gratitude for life is greed for more of it. It is the inability to enjoy what we have now because we are already lusting after the next edition. The Buddha was right. Craving is our curse. The desire for more our scourge. It has made us unhappy as well as ungrateful, and it might soon make our planet uninhabitable. So be brave in the face of death. Be sad at leaving, but don't let those be your final emotions. Let it be gratitude for the life you had. And even if you think there's no one there to hear you, say thank you. That's what the best poets do. And if you can't find the words yourself, read them instead. Here's how Clive James does it. A pause to grieve, burned by the starlight of our lives laid bare, and then no sound, no sight, no thought, nowhere. What is it worth, then, this insane last phase, when everything about you goes downhill? This much. You get to see the cosmic blaze and feel its grandeur, even against your will, as it reminds you just by being there that it is here we live, or else nowhere. 5. Defying Death. My father was born in 1904, and at the end of the Great War, when he was 14, he started serving his time as an apprentice block printer at the famous United Turkey Red factory on the banks of the River Leven in Alexandria. Block printers were the elite of the textile factories that ran along that swift-flowing river. They even had the right to wear bowler hats to work as a symbol of their status at the top of the journeyman tree. But while he was still a young man, changes in technology rendered his trade obsolete, and for the rest of his life he had to settle for any work he could get. He carried coal for years, but when the Second World War started, he was re-employed by the United Turkey Red dyeing cloth. And when they made him redundant again aged 60, he ended his working days as a porter in the Vale of Leven Hospital. He was the kind of man who endured hardship without complaining, but I often wondered how he felt about the way his life had played out. One day I discovered a clue. We lived in a classic Scottish two-roomed cottage known as a room and kitchen, with a recess in the kitchen for a bed. I was rummaging under the bed there when I came across a heavy bundle wrapped in old cloth. I pulled it out and found two heavy lead mallets with short wooden handles. They were your father's mills when he was a tradesman, my mother told me, for the block printing. I was a heedless child, but something about those symbols of his former status quietened and saddened me. Why had he kept them? A sense of betrayal and disappointment clung to them. Time and change have always robbed the poor of their occupations and of the pride and purpose they gave them. In human history, the buffeting of the poor seems to operate like a law as impersonal as karma. As befits a clever revolutionary species who can't leave anything alone for long, we are constantly inventing new ways of doing things, and just as constantly discarding those who had mastered the old ways, like my father with his treasured mells. This is a theme deeply embedded in Scottish literature, the sorrow of it caught by our best writers. At the end of Scotland's favourite novel, Lewis Grassic Gibbon's Sunset Song, the people of Kinraddy go up Blaweary Brae to dedicate the memorial to the four men of the town who fell in the Great War. And the minister preaches a short, powerful sermon. With them we may say there died a thing older than themselves. These were the last of the peasants, the last of the old Scots folk. A new generation comes that will know them not, except as a memory in a song. The last of the peasants, those four that you knew, took that with them to the darkness and the quietness of the places where they sleep. And the land changes. Their parks and their steadings are a desolation where the sheep are pastured. We are told that great machines come soon to till the land, and the great herbs come to feed on it. The crofter has gone, the man with the house and the steading of his own, and the land closer to his heart than the flesh of his own body. Nothing, it has been said, is true but change. Nothing abides. Nothing is true but change. Nothing abides. And I think of that sad wee bundle under the bed in Random Street, Alexandria. In Cloud Howe, the second volume in Gibbon's trilogy, we hear his main character, Chris, meditating on time and the change it brings. In a 10 years' time, what things might have been? She might stand on this hill, she might rot in a grave, it would matter nothing. The world would go on, young Ewan dead as his father was dead, or hither and born far from Kinraddy. Oh, once she had seen in these parks, she remembered the truth, and the only truth that there was, that only the sky and the seasons endured, slow in their change, the cry of the rain, the whistle of the winds on a winter night under the sailing edge of the moon. It was time himself she had seen, haunting their tracks with unstaying feet. As an old man, I am very conscious of time's unstaying feet, knowing how rapidly they're catching up on me. But I realize now I've been obsessed by time's rush my whole life long. I would pester my mother to tell me about the olden days, a phrase that haunted me. And the obsession was increased by my love of the movies. I was fascinated by the devices filmmakers used to signify the passage of time. They would show the pages of a calendar blowing away in the wind, or a street scene would dissolve into an older version of the same view, with horses and carts instead of automobiles. But it was the flashback that always got me, as it replayed shots from the movie I had just seen. I have a clear memory of the flashback from a movie I saw in 1945 when I was 11. The film was The Sullivans, the true story of a large Irish-American family of sons, five of whom were killed in the Second World War. I was captivated by the glimpses of the dead brothers at the end of the movie, and was stabbed by the sorrow of time's passing. Michael Cimino used the same technique in the sequence at the end of The Deer Hunter, where the surviving friends sit in a bar and sing God Bless America, as the screen flashes images of pre-Vietnam War innocence. The flashback at the end of Francis Ford Coppola's The Godfather Part II is even more poignant, recalling Michael's innocence before the inevitable assumption of authority corrupted him. I realize now I've been using this technique when speaking about dead friends at their funerals, such as this address I gave not long ago. The movie industry's best artistic invention was the flashback, those sequences at the end of a film when they run clips of the lives of the characters featured in the plot. But the flashback is not an invention of the cinema. It is art imitating life. It is what we all do as we rerun the movie of the life of one we have loved and lost. I've been seeing flashbacks of Doogie since the moment a couple of weeks ago when Rena phoned to tell me he had died. And they're all funny, usually terrible jokes, he told me, most of them unrepeatable here. It was the way he did it, I remember. I wouldn't have seen him for months, maybe even years, and he'd slope over to me with that gliding, slightly stooped walk he had, a smile playing round his lips. No hi or hello, just, an Angus farmer goes to London on business. I won't repeat that joke, except to say it involved a farmer receiving an unwanted enema at 3 a.m. in a dodgy hotel near King's Cross. Here's another clip. I've come to Dundee for an event at the cathedral where Doogie is now working in his retirement years. At the bun fight in the hall after the service, he approaches me. Again, there's no hi or hello. I notice he's put on weight. He comes over in that sliding, slightly stooped walk, a smile flickering round his lips, shoves his belly towards me, strokes it sensuously with his right hand and croons, "Solid muscle." This was the man who told his grandchildren he'd used his braces to bungee jump from the Eiffel Tower, and that in the olden days he'd fought and won a duel by ramming a stick of rhubarb down his adversary's throat. So what I remember most about Doogie was his sense of humour. It was Glasgow humour, and it was what bonded us. But it sat alongside a deep religious seriousness. Doogie was loyal to a traditional kind of Scottish Episcopalianism that has disappeared. The old Scottish church had nurtured him through tough times in his boyhood, and it had bred in him a passionate conservatism with a small c. Conservatives play an important role in the human community. We are a dynamic and restless species, constantly discarding the old and lusting after the new. And much of what we throw away is good and beautiful. Conservatives mourn this prodigal waste of the past and try to hold on to as much of it as they can. Old buildings, old words, old values, old courtesies and old trades are thoughtlessly abandoned by us in our rush through history. Careful conservatives try to hold back the flood of time and rescue what they can from its ruthlessness. Dougie hated what he saw as the shallow modernizing of his beloved church. Though I was one of the modernizers, our disagreements never came between us. This was partly because I respected the genuine conservatives' hatred of the carelessness of many progressives. But it was mainly because we were determined that nothing should ever be allowed to damage the love we had for each other. Dougie also understood that the trouble with holding too tightly onto the past is that you preserve the bad as well as the good, ugly prejudices as well as beautiful virtues. Change can bring gain as well as loss, but we should never ignore the cost to those who cherish the memory of what has been lost. It was typical of Doogie that he weathered the changes and learned to celebrate the best of them. He recognized that it was the role of the thinking conservative to test and challenge change, but once the community had decided upon it, to embrace it too. In the end, Doogie would allow nothing to separate him from the church he had loved since he was a boy. And even though our hearts are breaking because all we are left with is a film in our heads playing images of his laughter and his love, nothing will separate us from that love either. Films may have made remembrance of the past and those it has taken from us potently visual, flickering flashbacks, but poets and other writers were doing it long before the movies were invented. One of the time-haunted poets I've been reading for years has already appeared several times in these pages, Philip Larkin.